And how did you get, I mean, was that just, when did you get a vision for Metal Miner? I mean, what I mean is that's a big difference between where you started and where you are. And did you always have a sense that's where that was headed, or it just kind of happened?
So I think we had a sense that consulting, so basically what we found in the consulting part of our business was that we couldn't find the information and the tools that we needed to do a good job as a consultant.
Got it.
I couldn't find the price information that I actually needed. And it's basically because, and this is the example I love to tell, and everyone who's heard me talk knows that I say this all the time, but Ford does not put an aluminum ingot on their Ford F-150. They put a 5052 H32 aluminum coil on their Ford. And there's a $2,500 or more price gap between those two items. And so all that was in the market was the ingot price, whatever the LME price was, and the Midwest premium. And that's all you could get. So it was hard to, so in OEM land where I live with manufacturers, I'm trying to map their very specific materials that they're buying to whatever price index was out there and couldn't find very much. So we started in 2012 collecting our own data. And a lot of it was not begotten using an IOSCO process, if you will. Right. Some of it was trade data, which you can free to take. You're free to take government data. You're free to take trade data. But we just started putting a database together to inform our consulting practice.
So it was born out of a need.
It was born out of
a
need.
It was supportive.
Getting the data was to help us consult better. And, you know, so we're doing a project and somebody said, well, we're going to benchmark ferrochrome. So where are we going to get those prices? So that's kind of where. Yeah,
that's a good question.
You come to Metal Miner if you need ferrochrome.
Yeah. All you can handle.
Yes. Yes. So it started like that. It was kind of the need. And we built the database literally with bubblegum, duct tape, literally like two guys. And it was a terrible database. But anyway, it was the genesis of the business, right? It was sort of like when we need information, we could go to our database and pull data out. Mm-hmm. We never sold any of that data because it was not for client eyes for a lot of reasons.
Right.
So then we started, a lot of people would call us and say, do you have a forecast for any of this? What do you think aluminum's going to do? What do you think? And that became like, then we
hired. Did that surprise you the first time that happened? You're like, or did you kind of see that?
I saw it was happening. And more people were asking, like, where do you have a forecast for this? And so we would hire, I call them kids, but they're double master's degree candidates out of IIT, Illinois Institute of Technology. And there was a purchasing professor there that we worked with. And he would give me candidates, job candidates, and interns. And so I would bring these interns in to try to tackle specific problems. Mm-hmm. And one of the interns we hired, I said, we need to think of how we can do forecasting. And so we started trying to model things using multiple linear regression, mm-hmm. correlation, and all those tools. And it worked until we did the back testing, and then we couldn't get the models to work anymore. And I'll never forget the kid that I had working for me at the time. He started his own business. He basically, we're sitting at this long table. We were in the startup land. We're in this long 12-foot table. He's sitting at the end of the table, and he sends me an email. Okay, I'm sitting at the other end of the table.
All sitting there.
Yeah, we're all sitting there. He sends me an email and he says, I think we need to talk, but I think I'm going to need to quit. I don't have a way to create an aluminum forecast for you. I don't know how to build one. And I wrote him back and I'm like, do you think we should talk about this or should we send emails back and forth?
Right. You know? Are we doing this now?
So I basically said to him, I said, quitters never win and winners never quit.
Yeah.
I said, so I'm not firing you. And you need to figure out another way.
Yeah.
Like another way to do forecasting. I said, there has to be people in the world that do forecasting for commodities. Go find out what they're doing and copy it for us for metals. Figure out how we're going to do this.
Yeah.
So sent him on a research project. And he, I don't know, it took a few months. And he came back and he said to me, I think we need to use technical analysis to understand market movements. I'm like, okay, great. Where are you going to learn about that? And he bought this giant textbook, which, by the way, is the Bible textbook we give to everybody that comes in that forecast analyst role.
Okay.
So we started that in 2015, and this is where we worked with somebody from the CME who came to us, marketing guy, and he basically, voice of the customer, researched this thing to death to create sort of this format. Let's do one metal per page. So we cover the six base metals, the four forms of flat rolled steel. And this guy, you know, his name's Raul, built this kind of using technical analysis, and he would read the markets, and we put this report together. And that was in 2015. And we are still doing that report today. We do it now in a much more advanced way than we did it. I mean, we use AI because we have AI trained on our data and our database. So,
yeah.
And this kind of introduces sort of the next phase of our business. So as we've, you know, grown, we've been able to continue developing forecast capability. So we had a client in the energy sector approach us and say, we need a grain-oriented electrical steel price, but what we actually need is a forecast for the China price. But we don't want to use statistics. We want you to build a neural net.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, quick, let me go study up on what a neural net is. So we had our development team, and again, this is part of the advantage of working with these, you know, double master's candidates, young people, we're all learning on the job.
Right.
And we're learning to build a neural net. To create this forecast. And we worked with, this is a, what do I want to say, Fortune 50 conglomerate, giant company. And we worked with their firm statistician and a couple of PhDs, and they beat up on our models. And essentially we co-learned how to build one of these things. And then not very, maybe, I don't know, 8 or 10 months later, probably my timeline wrong, we were brought in through a company called Exiger that does a lot of supply chain risk management. And I had known an individual there that we'd been working with Metal Miner for a long time. He sold his business to Exiger. He said, I think there's an opportunity that we ought to go in together on, mm-hmm. and that is with DARPA. And that is to create their open program, which is to create supply chain visibility into price from mine to use and every step along the way. 50 critical
not
metals.
A small project.
Not a small project. And it's also the metals that, I mean, these are, I'm not going to swear on your podcast, but these are like the really hard metals where there's very little information on anyway. Like, you know, I'm not an expert in antimony, bismuth, gallium, germanium, hafnium, holmium, yttrium, neodymium.
Right.
I mean, these are not things that like motherhood and apple pie.
Sure.
You know, fabricators and OEMs are...
We don't learn that going through life.
No, we don't learn the nuances of cobalt or what's co-mined, and dysprosium's not available because it's only co-mined with another, et cetera. So we basically had to figure out how can we scale predictive models, get the error rate really low so that they were accurate, and then model in all this geopolitical stuff, all this geopolitical risk and everything else. So we've been at it for a year and a half. It's taken a long time to figure out kind of what you have to do that. But now we're able to scale a little bit better. Well, no, a lot better. We can scale because we can see what elements drive different markets, but it requires that domain expertise. And this is the difference between just a technologist doing this versus a domain expert. In other words, my hypothesis of what moves the aluminum market is going to be more accurate than somebody that doesn't have any metals experience. They're going to guess at some stuff. And I probably can make a good educated guess. So, and by the way, there's a ton of predictive capability from metal to metal, which again, only a metal nerd is going to really appreciate. But metals move in packs. Metal prices move in packs and in trends. So you can use other metal prices to predict other metal prices. So,
and there's also the relative nature of it where, you know, metal type one should never be more expensive than metal type two. Meaning like, you know, there is always going to be sort of, they're going to slot in a certain way from a pricing perspective.
Correct.
So when your model starts to push a certain type more expensive than another type, okay, that's never happened.
Right. When hot rolled coil is creeping in on the cold rolled coil price, you're like, what?
Yeah. You know, like The Porsche should never cost less than the Corolla.
Right, exactly.
It kind of is the idea.
Yeah.
And that it's simple thinking like that that actually is really useful.
Right, right.
High level.
So you have like a different challenge in trying to think through these minor used metals. Your hypothesis, you don't have the same hypothesis. First of all, they're not exchange traded. They're illiquid. Mm-hmm. There's a couple suppliers in the world for it. There's barely anything published on it. So it's like, how do you figure out what's going to predict that price? And there are cases where there is nothing that predicts it.
I would say there's got to be, there have to be dead ends. Like that's just no, I'm sorry.
Right.
Can't do this.
Exactly. So that's, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right? Mm-hmm. So, well, how are we going to predict this? So we figured out we needed to create some what-if modeling capability. I'm like, well, can we get expert on disruption events, geopolitical events, and understand at the metal and all through history what types of events create what kind of price impact and for how long? And the answer is yes, you can model that, it turns out. So, and this kind of ties into like modern day when we're talking about like tariffs and all the hysteria around tariffs. And I feel like I'm the only one saying things like, I'm not all that hysterical about price inflation. I don't think it's going to be as big a deal as everyone's making it to be. And all this panic, and people could say, why would you say that? And I could say, oh, well, I've modeled it. I can see that in the data. I'm not saying it has no impact. It definitely has an impact. In 2018, tariffs had between a 6 and a 9 month impact. But the acute pain was in the first 3 months. And mm-hmm. then after the first 3 months, the metal kind of slowly came down to its...
It chokes through.
Right. And people forget things like, I always say this, is one of my favorite lines, nothing kills high prices like high prices. Uh-huh. People change their behavior. When things are really expensive, you do things differently. It's kind of like, you know, when the market is falling, is that when you're buying, or are you going to wait until you are sure that it's done falling so that you're not?
And also, if markets persist in a negative way, when you talk about engineering design, people just start designing that stuff out.
Yes. Product substitution, 100%.
You know, they're 100%. Like, finally someone walks in and they're like, keep that stuff out of our designs. It's ridiculously expensive.
Right, right.
Same reason people would standardize windows in their houses when they build them versus...
Custom windows, exactly.
You know, so the ultimate correction for a market is how we design things.
Correct.
And you can just design yourself right out of the right. I mean, you can price yourself right out of the design.
Exactly. And that's what happened with nickel back in, not even the recent run up, but like I can't even forget the year, 2008, 2009, when mm-hmm. nickel went to $55,000 a ton. And everybody said, you know what? We don't need to have magnets stick to our refrigerators. We can use 430 stainless instead of 304, right? Like, because that necessity is the mother of invention. We're not paying that. Let's get the nickel content out of here. That's what's causing the pain.
So in speaking about these metals in the electric everything market, how is that squeezing these metals markets? I mean, when you talk about batteries, they're... So what have you seen? Because you've really had a front row seat to watching this.
I think the hype is all of the bite. Like, I think there's way more hype than there is. Now, let me clarify where I think there's hype and where there's not.
Yes.
So I think the EV clean tech market was overhyped. What I mean by like wind, solar, and that use. And I think that's really come off a lot in the United States. Like, that is not what is driving copper prices right now. It's grid, data centers. I mean, AI. That's what's driving the demand for those metals right now. I mean, there's not much wind project stuff going on right now. Solar is a thing still, but we're importing a lot of it. We're not making a lot of it. We're making some of it. But the use is not like the automotive industry, where it's just taking up big volumes. And people are not buying the EVs now because all the incentives have been taken away. So, you know, to me, the demand is really more on the data side, data centers and electrification, grid enhancements, everything power related.
And, I mean, grid enhancements, it's not always future tech. I mean, we just have an infrastructure we need to keep working.
Yes. And it's not, right? We're having like more brownouts, I live in Northwest Indiana. Yes, between the two steel mills. Yeah. And our power goes out all the time. And I never experienced that, you know, 5 years ago. That never happened. It goes out, you know, at least once a season. I mean, I put a generator in, and that generator, I'm probably going to have to replace the generator at some point.
So. Yeah, it's going to wear out.
Yeah.
And so the EV, do you feel like the hype was, it reminds me of an old debate I used to have. So I loved remote control cars growing up.
Fun.
And there was always, when you went to go get a new one, you're like, should I get an electric one or should I get a gas one? Because the gas one's great because I can fill it up and I can run it all day.
Right.
And with my electric remote control car, I've got to get a bunch of batteries, got to recharge it a lot, but there's no maintenance because right. there aren't all these moving parts. Right. So this debate has been part of my life for a very long time.
Wow.
Because and then eventually I got a gas powered one and I was like, I went back to electric because just for these little remote control cars, because like all I do is mess with that one to keep it working and this one. So there is this trade off
yeah.
between these two technologies. But I think that to what extent do you feel like it's misunderstood by people that you're just displacing the generation of the electricity, meaning that
correct.
All of that electricity that's in that car is not local to that car. It is coming from somewhere.
Yes.
And when you transmit anything over a distance, there is a loss. I don't care right. if it's water, electricity, right. whatever it is. So does it take more energy to pump that electricity across the country versus it being locally generated under a hood by an internal combustion engine?
I can't answer that question. Like, yeah. I have no idea, but you raise a good point. And I don't know, I'm not sure exactly where the science is landing right now. And people have strong opinions about
they
this
do.
And when they're doing what. And, you know, and I can see in my own usage where electric fits, but where gas also fits.
And for you, not speaking for the world, but like, when do you feel like gas is the right route?
So I definitely, when I'm touring and doing long distance driving, especially if it's not routine driving, I definitely want to be in my ICE vehicle.
Yes.
Listen, I have a place in Florida. I thought about, you know, I should put some solar panels up and I can drive for free. So I've thought, you know, we haven't done it yet, but because we're not there full time, but that makes a lot of sense to me. So I can see an electric vehicle for that. So I think it depends on your kind of your use case, your distance, what you're driving. You know, if you're driving big distance, but it's to and fro and it's predictable where you're going to the office or wherever you're going, it makes sense maybe to look electric. But if you're like driving for baseball games all over God's green earth and you're in towns that are literally, you know, have horse and buggies in them, which some do, and some of these Amish towns in Indiana, you know, I'm not sleeping comfortably like, where would I get charged if I needed a charge? So I think that gives me a lot of anxiety. So I'm a little bit mixed. So I could see in a family where you'd have both, you know, and I see a use case for both.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And I'm gonna pivot hard in this conversation.
Okay.
Something that we both think is interesting, which is critical thinking.
Good subject.
Yeah, it is a good subject. Before we can talk about it, will you tell me what it is?
Let's see if I can give a good definition.
No rush. You can.
Yeah. I think it's the ability to question fundamentally and not necessarily having the answer, but being able to question anything that's being presented to you and to be able to look at something via a different lens altogether. We recently joined a think tank organization as a member, and I like the way they present issues. They give you the point of view, and then they give you the counterfactual.
Mm-hmm.
And this notion of a counterfactual, which is like an alternative viewpoint, it goes back to, I'm going to come back to the beginning of this conversation. What do you think the public policy intervention should be on this business issue? It's the alternative. It's the other one that you haven't thought through. And so I don't know if I've defined it well, but I kind of think of it as being able to question something to bring up and create in your own mind an alternative point of view, be able to attack something with that different lens and to build up your own, whatever it is, if it's an idea or a concept somebody presented or a counter argument, whatever it may be. So that's what I kind of think it is.
Yeah, but it's not in a rebellious way of thinking. It's just a let's trust but verify. Let's keep thinking this.
I think of it as a continuous learning. Like I'm a lifelong learner.
Mm-hmm.
You don't learn if you don't question, if you don't ask those questions. Well, how does that work? Well, why didn't that work for you before? I mean, even when you and I were talking about your business, what worked when you started it? Why didn't that work? So what did you do next? Then what did you do? What, you know, and through that, you have a more, I think, holistic view and not one that's just sort of like from the textbook. And so critical thinking as a topic is not in vogue right now.
Okay, so why is it important?
Why is it important?
The question is, so critical thinking is to think critically of your thinking.
Right.
Right?
Right, and to consider alternatives. Because I think we as people get tunnel vision. We pick the news channels that match our politics. We hang out with people that are like us. And so there is a natural tendency to seek out that which is like me.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is then you can miss things. You can miss really important things, like maybe even critical things, because you're not opening yourself to that alternative, whatever that alternative might be.
So critical thinking, do you think it's important though?
I think as a business owner, you have to be a critical thinker, not just a problem solver, but a critical thinker. Like how would that work? Let's play that out. But what if they did this? Then how would it be? Well, let me lay out three scenarios. And would it still work in all three scenarios? Or where would it fall? And I think people sometimes just pick something, they go with it, they try it, they see if it works. I think critical thinking might be a time saver. Not always. I think it's an
amazing rapid prototyping system, critical thinking,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
If you can sit there and kind of, I call it the cone zone, which is if you can get in the cone zone.
There you go.
And just
love that.
And you sit there and then you formulate what you think are some good ideas, or maybe you want to find out if they're bad ideas. You bring in group and you really have to structure critical thinking sessions though, which is like, let's not worry about that right now. We got to stay right on this, sort of beat up this one very linear thought. Because we can't get concentric. We've got to stay on this middle piece.
Right.
And really, I guess, pressure test this and why and why and why.
Yes, and
why,
and you get to keep
why
unraveling, or why not?
Yeah.
Why not? Why won't that work? You know, I think the other thing that I like to do, and I feel like I'm that person in the company, I'm out kind of looking around the universe, and I'm going to pick weird things that I'm like, is this something we should look at? Is this something we should do? I'm just asking the question.
Mm-hmm.
And then I give it to different team members. And initially, everyone's reaction to almost everything is no.
No. Yeah.
And
always.
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. And then I'll say, okay, that's fine. You can say no after you've looked at it, mm-hmm, and dove into it. And then give me the why. And sell me on why no. So I had one of those recently where I had heard on a podcast about, I don't even know what it's called. It's like some way that you connect your data to a large language model. So the large language model could query your data very efficiently without the large language model sucking in your data, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
so
it's still your spying happening.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so I send it to one of our developers. Should we do this? You know, I don't think so, no. And then, you know.
It literally drives me insane.
But then this individual is like, a superstar. So he, you know, his gut was no, but he, you know, looked into it and he came back and he goes, maybe yes. You know, and so I'm like, now tell me why. And so he kind of like gave me the logic and he's like, here's a little test case. And I was playing with it. And so I feel like my job as the CEO is to just insert the tiny bombs, not big ones, little ones, to say, is this what we should do? Or not do. You know, I know you and I were chatting about it's easier to grow wallet than it is to acquire a new client.
Yes.
I said, so it's time we probably need to add somebody in as a client success person in our business and really think through how can we add more value more deeply with our existing clients. And you'd think after how long we've owned this business, we would have done that, you know, years ago. But anyway, we're doing it now.
Well, it's easy to get sucked into the operation of anything.
Right.
Meaning
right.
That's,
yes.
It's
that's right.
It's clear and present what needs to happen when you're operating. Like, oh, this needs to be dealt with. Versus growth, it's very deliberate. Like, we need to take a time out. I know that thing's on fire over there, but we have to ignore that for right now.
Yeah.
And I became really sensitive to that when I was in distribution, which is you must create time to grow.
We call it working on your business versus in your business.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And it's not an accident.
That's right. You have to purposefully say, I'm going to focus on this. We're going to solve this piece.
And it's a little bit uncomfortable. And the reason I got sensitive to it was you hear so much. So when I became CEO of the business in distribution, I would say, why do we do it that way? They say, because that's the way we've always done it.
Of course.
And so that means to me, okay, you had a new situation arise, a set of circumstances or a use case, and somebody said, well, as a Band-Aid, we'll do this right here, right now. And that became doctrine.
Right.
And how many businesses are built on these layered Band-Aids?
Yes.
And it's an unpopular thing to go through that and tear it all down. But that's what has to happen.
Exactly.
Or else you just keep, it is a Band-Aid, and now your ops are built on top of Band-Aids.
And people don't know why it was like that in the first place, so, you know.
Yeah, it's how I was trained.
Right.
Someone showed me how to do it that way.
This goes back to critical thinking. So how can we reimagine how we do this in a better way, and what should that way be?
Yeah.
You know, in our business, I look at, and come back to price reporting, you know, the way that it's always done by the industry is through a survey method, either web-based or phone-based. And I'm going to rip on it right now because we don't do it that way. But people, large companies will come in and they'll say, I don't trust the number. And I'll say, why don't you trust the number? He's like, because I don't know who else is in the benchmark group. I have no visibility. I don't know if they're talking to Joe's Garage Shop or another Fortune 500 company. But I'll tell you, we're buying differently. Like, we are.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a trust issue. And as we looked at our business, I said, I don't want to get into a confrontation with a client or a prospect. How can we do this differently? And so, you know, our methodology is like open kimono. And they're basically theoretical should cost models. We basically say, all right, what is it you're trying to figure out? They're like, well, it's an aluminum alloy. I'm like, okay, let's get the recipe of what goes into that aluminum alloy. And literally, I went to a scrap dealer, a friend of mine, brought some donuts, and I'm like, how does this work? Somebody comes in, they bring this. So we're going through literally piles, scrap piles of heaps of garbage. He's like, all right, this is our, you know, truckload mix. You know, this is our alloyed material. So I'm understanding that the truck is mixed with different alloys and grades. Industrial comp is different than, you know, 6000 series and et cetera. And so we were able to sort of from the bottoms up create literally like the soup recipe of how do you make this alloy? It's got a little silicon, it's a little moly, a little copper, mm-hmm. et cetera. And we pull the price feeds for each of these different elements and assign weights. That's how we created battery indexes. And you go and you show that to an OEM and you show them. This is what we did. And we pulled all these numbers in. No argument. No disagreement. No challenging that. They're like, yep, that looks like the price that I'm paying, you know, is usually what we get. Sometimes we get, well, yours a little higher, mine's a little lower, vice versa, whatever. But that process creates trust in the relationship, that transparency. And I said, well, like, why should we do it just because everybody else does the survey or the web-based? Now, they are reporting that number, but not all of those are exchange traded. So they're numbers that are in the market that people transact by, but are they good numbers? I don't know.
Well, it's kind of like what your house is listed for and what it's sold for.
That's it.
Right?
That's it.
And you can list it for whatever you want. And that's similar to us, which is, you know, how do you become a reliable, indisputable index?
Right.
by having real strike prices.
Yeah.
Like these aren't
what people really paid.
This literally just occurred.
Yes.
And so these are buyers and sellers that do this for a living. So it cannot be disputed.
Correct.
Because there are great reasons why they would not want to overpay, and the great reasons why they wouldn't want to sell it for too cheap.
Right.
So it really becomes just the source of truth.
Exactly.
And that's powerful in an opaque world. And
you can do something with that at some point.
Yeah.
Right? You'll be able to monetize that data in a different way.
Yeah. And for right now, it's really about demonstrating to buyers and sellers that this is not only can it be done, it is being done.
Right.
And that they can be comfortable with that.
Right.
And so that's probably, we interface with buyers and sellers and these participants in a different way, Metal Miner versus Brizos.
Right.
But
right.
Ultimately, we're all circling around the same concept, which is this digital trust and the study of behavior and what gets people to move or lean into what you believe is what is best for not just them, but what's really good for a supply chain in general.
Exactly.
And just trying to work our way. And it's all got to be done together, where we've all seen instances where, having an immense amount of resources is no guarantee of getting the market to follow.
Exactly. No way. Right. Exactly. It's all about getting that customer trust and creating that credibility in their eyes. And, we probably do that differently, both of us and our individual companies. But I think if you don't have trust, you have nothing. And so, for us, we kind of tout our track record. We're like, look at it. We'll show you our models. We'll show you our error rates. We'll show you the back tests. We show this to companies. And that we don't expect them to transact off of that.
Mm-hmm.
But they, start using it. And as it performs, they start building that trust over time. And even though it was back tested, they may still need that trust. And then there's other magic in the market that happens from that. So, how do you look at price and figure out, do I have a supply assurance problem? Am I going to be in trouble for something critical to my operation because I'm going to have an availability issue?
Yeah.
Which is, we see that a lot right now,
And that's a tough thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially when we're getting down into, I can only speak to us, which is transactionally speaking, what is going to be the distribution and abundance of these metals that are ready to be moved. I mean, it's nearly like an ecology thing, which is like distribution abundance through space and time. That's what we're trying to understand.
So interesting.
So it's an ecological thing.
Yeah, interesting.
Of these different species, if you will, of metals.
I love that. I love the analogy, and maybe I need to pick up on that, because I think like the critical minerals, for example, are just, they're an animal to themselves, and there's, it's like a little island. It's almost like a rare sighting, if I could use your analogy. It's a rare sighting of a very rare bird that, doesn't appear very often.
Yeah.
How do you create the conditions so that the bird comes more?
Yeah, people will pay a lot to have it in their possession, just like metals.
Yes.
So back to critical thinking. Is critical thinking, I think we agree, maybe it's under threat.
I think it's under threat. I know it's under threat. I don't have to think. I know. And I think there's two areas where it's...
Okay, you should tell me about that.
And I'm curious if you agree or what you see. So I think two areas. One, our educational system is we're indoctrinating kids. I'm not going to get any more political than that. But I question if we're not teaching kids, if they're not using Socratic method and discussing and debating in a circle with one another and talking different concepts through, I worry that we're just indoctrinating and not giving an opportunity for someone to say, I disagree with you,
mm-hmm.
or here's what I think you're wrong, or I think your facts aren't correct. You don't have that today as much, I don't see, in school. And I have sent 3 kids through school, and I think that's a big challenge. That's one piece. The second, so we're graduating people that I'm not sure are good critical thinkers. The second thing, of course, is AI.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot. I mean, I hear the colleges rumbling about it. I have a friend who's a sociology professor, and she's rumbling about, you know, kids are, you know, she basically lays down the law when they come into school. And she said, if you think you're going to submit a paper to me that you've generated through AI, I'm telling you, I test these papers six ways from Sunday. Mm-hmm. You're going to fail this class. So really, same thing, trying to get people to use the AI as part of the answers to what you're critically asking. So it's almost like the why. Explain this. Well, why is it like that? What are the risks of that? But why is it? You know, just unpeeling the onion, the onion, the onion. And using the AI to, again, try to get a more 360 view of what it is that you're looking at. And that's that critical thing. Like, that's the right way to use AI.
Yeah, the use it way. Like your encyclopedia at the library. It's just a resource for you to formulate your own thinking.
And click the links to see if they're legit.
Yeah, that's a hard next step.
That's a hard next step, but there's a lot of hallucinations. There's a lot of garbage information out there. You literally have to click the links and see what the links say to validate your learning and understanding.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a summarized internet to a degree. And you think about all the people out there that are pushing that information into the internet, and it's like, well, maybe we shouldn't assume this is right.
Have you ever had an argument with an AI where you decided you were just going to like screw around with it a little bit?
Yeah,
to see
of course.
How it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun to see. I love how when they say, well, oh, I hadn't considered that. Or I may have, you know, not looked into that more deeply. And I'm like, well, yeah.
Yeah, I think getting a little uppity with the AI.
Right.
Well, you think about it. People think about words differently than vision, than images. But anyone who's created an image on AI, okay, you described it, and that's what they give back to you. That's just a visual representation of what they're giving you in words.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
They're giving you something that is sort of, but there's a lot of wrong in there.
Yes.
At the same time. Now, I'm not a poo-pooer of AI. I think it has, you know, both exciting and highly threatening implications.
Yes.
And anyone who's listening, I would say this is not something to steer clear of. You've got to figure out how to live in harmony with this thing.
Yes, you have to tame it.
You do, because if you've got your head in the sand, there will be a point you wish you had not.
Right.
Because I think it's not coming down the track. I mean.
Oh, it's here. And so, I mean, look, we're already seeing like white collar work is, I think, some of it is under threat. A lot of it is to help people perform better. It's an enhancer. It's a production efficiency, you know, kind of thing, a tool that allows people to do more. But I think it definitely is going to automate anything that's like a mundane task. So again, this comes back to critical thinking. There's demand in the workplace for critical thinkers. If you're a critical thinker, you can be in our team because you're going to question something. So my latest one that I, you know, it's just like the Nippon Steel, U.S. Steel merger and that whole, you know, is it going to happen, not happen? And, you know, a lot of people said no. And that's true in the sense that the political parties wanted that. You know, it was politics.
Yes.
But if you actually looked at the underlying rationale and the state of U.S. Steel and the health of Nippon Steel and where they're good and where they're strong and where U.S. Steel needs help and where, you know, so on and so forth, and the future of steel in America, it, like, if you critically thought through the whole thing, you could see why and how the deal made sense. It's just a matter of, like, were rational minds going to be looking at
this?
Well,
yeah, I think U.S. Steel, I think, still resonates as a really good brand with a lot of people. And it is, but there's systems there that just simply need to be updated.
Yeah.
You know, it's that simple. And bringing in fresh, just really some good energy infusion.
Right.
Otherwise, to really drive it into the future, I think.
New technology and just operationally. Right. So, again, critical thinking. It's like, so somebody says something, the ability to question and to have the confidence to question it, to say, I don't know, that I don't think that makes sense. Explain to me why that makes sense. Walk me through that.
It's really hard, I think, because it takes a lot of practice, because you've got to keep emotion out of it.
Yes.
You must. And it's no different than if you're sitting there trying to write a song, for instance, and you're judging what you're writing before you complete it, you'll never finish it.
Correct.
You'll be like, this sucks. No one will ever want to hear this. And you will never write it.
Right.
But if you're like, no, get this thing out of your brain.
Barf it out.
Just get it out of your brain. And then work the problem.
Yes.
And so that's the idea, is critical thinking is, if you cannot have a really structured way of thinking, or let me say it differently, it's very hard to have structured thinking with rampant emotion, meaning it's going to just thwart that thing immediately, because you're like, no, I've got the right ideas and all this. But if you don't, so you have to be used to just being, you're not even being challenged, you're just working a problem.
Right, right.
You know?
So I think this critical thinking piece, I have a friend that's writing a book on yin and yang, and apparently I think it's a yang skill to question, to push against authority a little bit. And I mean, that's part of what critical thinking is. And I think
I hate the push against authority, because that's just what the non-creative type people say. Like, well, you put this the way we do it. I'm like, we're not pushing against authority.
Okay.
We're just saying, like, it's always been this way. You think every 100 years, we should just check in and make sure it's still the right way to do it.
Yes, right, right. Exactly, exactly.
That's like, we're not undermining you.
Right, right. And, you know, it's like question for clarity. And I think part of it for me is journalism training teaches you to do that. You just, you know, ask question. By the way, neurodiverse learners also can learn like that. That's how they learn. They don't learn by reading and writing or listening. They learn by a series of questions. I know, because I have a neurodiverse kid, but that's how he learns. Just ask question. And then you suddenly realize he's asked so many questions. He's like an authority on it.
He's banking data.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just so, you know, and I always call myself the LCD in the company, the lowest common denominator.
Right.
Like, if somebody puts a concept in front of me that's too difficult to understand, then I'm like, okay, guys, you have to explain this to the dummy. Like,
take it down a rung.
Yeah, down. Like, what? I don't understand. You know, and just dumb. And then you understand something. And then you're able to contribute as a critical thinker because you have the deep understanding, versus when somebody just throws a concept and you're too afraid to say, I don't understand that. Or, like, that's the other thing. And being able to be a critical thinker also, like, put pride aside, and it's okay if you don't know something and just ask.
Yeah, intellectual, like, humility.
Yeah. Who cares if you don't know? There are things I'm not going to know. I'm really bad at, like, pop knowledge slang, you know? I mean,
it's not your thing.
It's not my thing. So, or, you know, those emojis where, or not emojis, but those little, you know, be right back, like BRB or whatever.
Yeah, the lingo?
No.
Yeah, I'm not so good at that either, by the way. And, like, computationally good, but I can't really hold numbers in my head. Mm. You know, like, I can sit and do, like, I know it needs to be done, but I can't hold, like, some people can just, I'm not even talking about, like, savant type stuff. I'm talking more just normal, like, you can hold 5-10 numbers in your head.
Right.
And mine just hit the floor.
Same. I don't have, like, memory. As you have already heard, I don't have good memory for a lot of things. And I think it's, like, overload, brain overload. But
yeah, I think there's a lot competing for what's getting, like, the most of the brain.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
Which is why, you know, we're writing it all down. But what are things, when you're looking at critical thinking, do you see a way back? Like, how do we... Or do you think this is something that's under threat and is just...
I'm really worried that it's under threat, because I don't see our educational system, broadly speaking, talking about a lot of public schools, really harvesting and I mean, they use words like collaboration and project work. Yes, I see that in schools. They're using the new technology. But are they discussing and debating? Are there two points of view in a class on any topic anymore? Or is there just one point of view? And I think when you don't have multiple points of view inside of any organization, there's not a lot of critical thinking that's happening.
So right.
You need people to push back on you and push back hard. And it's not personal, right? You don't take it personally. Like, push back hard. I don't think that's happening in K-12 education at all.
I would, maybe beyond 12.
For sure, college. For sure. Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. And so I think it's under threat. I'll tell you, even in our own company, you know, I think about, I go back to like a resume. What do you put on your resume? I go, don't tell me what you've done. Tell me what you've accomplished. Like, I don't care what you've done. I don't care the tasks of your job. It's, I don't really care. But what, show me what you've accomplished and how you think about what's important. Because what your accomplishments are telling me what you've valued and what you've, you know, put effort into in order to be successful at.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of thing. So I think as we are screening candidates, I'm looking for people that are, you know, that can show a track record of accomplishment, that are, that embrace the technology and aren't, don't run from it, aren't worried that they're going to get fired or laid off, but instead are saying, how can I use AI to 10X me?
Right.
And be,
use it as a steroid.
Yes, use it as a steroid. What a great way to say it.
Yeah.
You know, use the AI as a steroid and not be like so hung up on, you're worried you're going to lose your job over it.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're like,
I'm not saying you won't, but
right. But if you're doing a really like repetitive job, that those are the things that AI can is going to take away. So, you know, my son always says, think about things you can do with your hands. You know, jobs that you can do with your hands are not, you know, the humanoid's not there yet.
Right.
It will be a while before they're totally perfected and being able to do that. So obviously I'm talking about the trades, things that you do with your hands, but also field work, field testing, testing equipment, testing things where you're, you know, it does require your hands, but you're not behind a desk or you're not.
It is the opposite of when we were growing up.
Yes.
It used to be like, hey, if you could use a computer, you know, right, you're going to
be
run
be
the
a
world.
Knowledge worker.
Yeah. And you know? Now, and it was. Now it's swinging the other way, which is like if you can go out and hammer something or be out in the field and do something, you're going to have a job.
Right, right, exactly.
You know, where can you be where AI is not?
That's exactly right. So, it's a big challenge, but it's also a challenge in people that you talk to. Even just conversationally, it's just, you know, getting people to engage, I think, forces. I'm like, okay, I always say it to my friends, and if we're not of the same political persuasion, I'm like, I'm stepping on the third rail here, but, and then I'll say something, you know, do we think it was good that Trump bombed Iran, you know, or whatever, just to get somebody to like talking. And then again, same thing, like 360, everyone, you know, 360, give me, there's lots of ways to skin this cat, you know.
Yeah, and you're like, so, well, yeah, I read that same headline too, but what do you think?
Right.
You know, like, what do you think?
Yes.
And getting someone to, and that's, then you get
they're
the
struggling.
Silence and you're like,
yes.
Okay, now you're starting to think because you're not saying anything.
Right. Right. And I want you to think. Right. And I actually wrote about that in our newsletter. Just I pulled a bunch of headlines, actually that exact topic. I pulled a bunch of headlines that I said, if you didn't critically think, you would think this is all true. Inflation's going to skyrocket. Gas prices are going to skyrocket. Tariffs are going to be terrible. We're going to be in it. Like all those things you might believe if you, again, aren't critically thinking. And I just think it's going out of fashion. And I don't know how we get it back, but we need it.
Well, I guess it's going to have to come back.
I hope we don't get replaced by the machines that are doing the critical thinking. That's the scary part.
That's going to be something that's going to be hard to unring.
Yeah.
And, it's going to, I don't know. It's hard to say what's going to happen, but it's happening quickly. I know that much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that it's going to go too far and there's going to be a bullwhip effect of how it's managed. Right now it feels like it's just sort of running. And
Right. Without the
it's kind of Wild West.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
How the internet was Wild West. All this stuff kind of comes in and then you're like, okay, that was a step too far, and how do we manage that?
Right.
And
right.
I don't know when or what that looks like, but I think there is at least a historical pattern of we let it run, and
yeah,
then we pull it
I
back.
I think that's, you know, and now the game's changed, right? We're competing against China. We have to think about what's their, again, the counterfactual, what's their operating model? How are they doing it?
Yeah.
How are we going to do it? And now if we put a bunch of regulatory handcuffs on how we're going to do it, but China is running loose.
Now we're falling behind the pack.
We're going to fall behind the pack. So, you know, what training data are they using in their models versus what training data we have in our models? Well, they're using the outside internet or some of it, you know, and so we have to think more, you know, it comes back to critical thinking. I actually think this historically has always been what differentiates Americans, especially a lot of entrepreneurs and startups. We are more, maybe it's not critical thinking, but we're seeing the gaps and we've taken advantage of the gaps. And, you know, here in America, you can fail and try again, and fail again and try again. And, you know, and I think most businesses are a version of that. Fail, redo, fail, redo, fail, redo.
Don't we call them pivots?
Pivots, yes.
That like the nice word for that sort of
yes,
thing?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We are going to pivot over here.
There's
going to
be a pivot. Some information's come to our attention, and we are now going to pivot.
We are now going to pivot. Exactly, and I think we have to be open. And again, that's being a critical thinker yourself to say, okay, I'm not stupid. If you like, what's the definition of insanity? Keep doing the same thing over and over and thinking you're going to get a different result. So, you know, if you don't mix it up, you're not going to move your business along. So you have to kind of look at it.
Well, I think a pivot is an ultimate example of do setting aside emotion. Like you're reading what's happening in front of you and you're being like, okay, everything here is saying, don't do what we're doing.
Right.
And but we've worked so hard. You have to just toss all that and be like, if we're going to do this, we got to go this way.
Right. Exactly.
You know, that's.
And think of the alternative also. Like what's an alternative way to do it? And does that make sense? And it helps you kind of crystallize that. I think you talked about just like staying in the middle and, you know, having the alternatives and stuff. So,
and I think it's also a drive towards simplicity, which is, okay, we've got the right idea, but how do we make it, how do we just whittle this thing down to something that is so simple that it just can't be misunderstood for anything than what we're trying for it to be.
I think that, and that's that other acronym, Keep It Simple, Stupid, right? KISS.
Yeah.
Which I think you have a great focus at being able to do that, which I think is really great. And I kind of convert that statement to LCD. Like, let's make it, like, if I can understand it, like, you know, the life commercial, like, then Mikey tried it, he'll eat it, he'll eat anything. Like, if I can understand it, anyone can understand it, you know?
No, that's right. It needs to be, the goal is to have, you know, something that requires zero demo.
Right.
The second they see it, they feel like they've been using it their whole life.
Yes.
And I also use the idea of a water slide, which is when you get up to the top and you go, you're going to go to the bottom of that.
I hate this.
Some
of them are really strong. They're like.
Well, let me kind of pull us together here, which is back to Metal Miner, which is how do people find you if they want to learn more about what you guys are doing?
That's great. I appreciate that question.
Yeah.
First of all, we're starting to make sure that we're answering questions so that people find us in the AI, in the different AIs, in ChatGPT and Perplexity, which are kind of the two biggies. I think Gemini is going to be the third one.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find us on our website, agmetalminer.com.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all our contact information is there. But we have a pretty decent LinkedIn presence. Can't say that I'm doing much on Twitter or Facebook or the others, but I would say LinkedIn. We're on LinkedIn. We do a lot of speaking events, but we're also, I think it's been fun, this little, I won't use the word pivot, but you know, this, hey, how do we stay relevant? Let's make sure we're answering the questions that people want answers to when it comes to metal prices.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, when somebody says, where are steel prices headed for 2026, that Metal Miner shows up as a link with some thoughts on that, right? So that's, you know, that's really, and quite frankly, I prefer to be found based on questions than SEO terms, because SEO terms always imply that somebody who's bigger can outspend us for those keywords or whatever, or even organically. But when people are looking, this is, you know, Google has its own existential issue, but, you know, when you come into AI and you want to know, you know, should I buy now? Should I buy later? Like, we're going to be able to help companies answer those questions. I have an aluminum buy coming up. Should I wait? Should I buy now? How much should I buy? When should I buy? You can query our data and get a large language answer to that that's trained on our data.
Okay, so you guys are in many places.
Many places.
Well, that's great. Well, I want to say thank you for coming on today. It's been really fun talking to you.
Same here.
Yeah.
Super fun.
All right, thank you. What?